Hello, this is Firestarters, the UK's first social enterprise podcast in health, and I'm Dave Dawes, and this is part three of a workshop on creating a social enterprise that we ran recently. And if you missed parts one and two, you might want to go back and listen to those. Okay, so we're talking about structures. So the kind of questions that you should be asking, or someone should ask you, in deciding your structure, things like power and control. Kind of uncomfortable words, particularly if you're a nurse, phrase like power and control. But who has the power and control over the way this thing makes a decision? If you appoint 15 non-exec directors and you're the founder, and you don't really know them from Adam and you've never really thrashed it through, they have control. And in fact, one of the things that unraveled is when you start getting outvoted. And a lot of people, I said, a lot of the structural stuff, your memorandum and articles, you'll pay quite a lot of money. Well, you can pay a lot of money. I wrote our own memorandum and articles because we had no money. So I just copied and pasted. I downloaded about 25 off the internet. I went, I like that paragraph, I like that paragraph. They got looked at by a lawyer about 4.5 years ago, and he went, who wrote these? And I went, I did. Why? They're all rubbish. And he went, no, they're not rubbish. But the writing style is really different from paragraph to paragraph. And I went, yes, because I copied and pasted that. Took that bit from Oxfam, that bit from the RCA, that bit from this, and I wrote that bit myself. And he went, well, you've kind of got everything in there. But I would recommend paying someone. But you will never look at them until there's a problem. So in my first social enterprise, for instance, we had to sack a director very early on, which is not a pleasant experience. Because I'd seen a registered charity that had tried to sack a director and couldn't, because they actually didn't have the power in the memo and articles on how to do it, I'd added in a clause that said actually the majority of directors could remove a director, was in there, and that's what happened. And this person was livid and actually hadn't read their own memorandum articles. But I would say there are clauses in there about stuff like powers of the board, removal of directors, appointment to directors, winding up the company, that are kind of important, and you never look at them until there's a crisis. And another issue, one of the issues about power and control, and this is in the public domain, so I can talk about this. The Royal College of Nursing, of which I've been a member for yonks and been on the board and so forth, decided to sell Cavendish Square, its national headquarters, last year. And a bunch of us didn't like that, so we had a rummage through the Constitution and found out that ordinary members could force through an extraordinary general meeting. All we needed was 1,000 signatures. So we got together, we got 1,000 signatures, we called a meeting, we put the meeting through, resolution went through, and it was binding, and they couldn't sell it. Now, an awful lot of people had never even looked at that clause. And we were rummaging through, and we were looking at like 70-year-old, 80-year-old legal documents that had these kind of powers in it. If you have a model where, say, you have a bunch of members, one of the things you have to be aware of is you could have what I call the Doris the Cleaner syndrome. So let's say you're running a load of services, and you're saying we've got to keep our pay low, and then Doris the Cleaner stands up and goes, vote for Doris. Doris will give you all a 20% pay rise. And everyone goes, yeah, vote for Doris. Okay, Doris is now on the board. And they've just removed you. So that can happen. So you need to kind of think, okay, who's got the power and control, particularly in the early days? If you're going to have other directors, you need to trust those directors. You need to understand each other. You need to be able to handle disagreements together. Because if you don't, when you first hit a disagreement, if that disagreement goes the wrong way, it can wind up companies. Steve Jobs founded Apple, and Steve Jobs was sacked by his own board of directors 4 years later.
That's what happened in the Smart Charity report last week.
Yeah.
He said he's having problems because now he's decided not to be chair because he's set it up. So he's now just on the board, and the board are not agreeing to go the way that he wants. They haven't got the same visions when they just started. So and he's like, well, what can I do? I'm like, well, I'm not sure unless you show me terms of reference
and your memorandum. Yeah.
So I can have a look.
Yeah.
He said the only thing I can think of is wait till the term of office is up and vote me in.
Yeah, I mean,
that was the only sneaky way we could come up with.
Absolutely. And sometimes people go, oh, you shroud wave a bit. I said, maybe it's my personality. I tend to think worst case scenario. So when I travel, they're going to lose my luggage. Do I have in my hand luggage photocopies of my passport, my driving license, my insurance? And do I have a change of underwear? And can I survive 24 hours without having luggage? What if that got stolen? Well, that could happen. So it's that kind of thinking. So issues of power and control, issues of accountability. You want to be accountable to people. And if so, who do you want to be accountable to? People quite often go, oh, we want to be accountable to the local community. And I go, okay,
Are you ever going to make a decision that the local community might not support? Foundation Trust is an interesting one. I'm dying to wait until the first Foundation Trust tries to shut one of its cottage hospitals and realises that in the Constitution, all it takes is 100 pissed off local people to get together and the board is gone. And that will happen. And I've seen small charities...
Or one pissed off person and lots of very passive people.
Yeah, or all their relatives. Yeah. A couple of good big Catholic families and you can collect all the signatures you need.
Yeah.
So when people say, oh yeah, we want to be accountable, so yeah, you're accountable to people who can remove you if they disagree with you. So decide, because a lot of this stuff is decide who you want to give the power to get rid of you from your own social enterprise. Because in effect, always someone will, but you can just decide how you want to do it. Apart from my new kick, which actually has a paragraph in that says they can't ever do it. And a few people have looked at it. Yeah, I've got a paragraph that says, Dave Dawes, as a named individual, has five powers. I can overrule the appointment, the removal of a director, the issuing of share capital, the winding up of the company and something else. And people have said, what's that about? And I said, that's the nuclear button. If ever we get really big and we become a £50 million international social enterprise and have a huge board and they go, Dave, we don't want you anymore. And I go, I think you'll find you don't have that power. Oh, and power six is you can't change the rules without my approval. So, nice one. So, I'm like thinking, you know. So, the other issue is, are you going to raise money? How are you going to raise money? If you're going to fundraise, life's a lot easier as a registered charity. There are a lot of funding bodies that will not fund you if you're not a registered charity. It's just worth being aware of. A lot of social enterprises go, I don't really want to fundraise anyway. And I go, fine, that's cool, just be aware. I applied to 205 charitable funds 2 years ago, and I got 204 rejection letters, to the point where I couldn't open the mail anymore.
Is that because you weren't a registered charity?
Most of them said that, even though they explicitly said they didn't just fund registered charities, because the ones that said that I didn't write to. So 205 people who said they funded bodies other than registered charities, in reality, didn't. Mm. So it got to the stage where it was really funny, I wasn't opening the mail anymore. I felt like what it must be like to be an out-of-work actor. Every morning I was opening the mail, getting rejection letter, rejection letter. I was like, I'm not opening the mail till I've had two coffees and it's a sunny day. And I let it build up. It's just rejection letter. Yeah. So equity, if you're going to raise it through equity, then you need some equity, which means you're going to need some share capital. It's worth thinking about. And the legal costs. Some of these things will be more... A limited liability partnership is probably the most expensive one. The more a lawyer has got to do personalised work on it, you are paying them by the hour. If, like me, you write your own memorandum and articles, because I'm sort of getting a dab hand at it now, nothing's gone disastrously wrong in 5 years, you can sort of get away with it. One of the beauties of being a KIC, and absolutely bless them, I have a soft spot for the KIC regulator. They've got some strange powers, but they're sweet human beings, is they give you complete draft free memorandum and articles. So depending on what you want to do, you can download it. It's got stuff like insert your name here, put here what you want to do, this paragraph is this, you can't alter these five paragraphs because we'll check them, they have to be exactly as we've written. Wonderful. So if you sort of know your way around, but as I said to people, I will very happily have a look at someone's memorandum and articles for them. And it's just kind of stuff I look for. And it's generally removal of directors, handling disagreements, annual general meetings, it's that kind of stuff. But yeah, bless their cotton socks. You can do a KIC one yourself, pretty much. But if you get it wrong, and it comes to bite you years to come, I mean, the RCN are now trying to change the limit of signatures, which is, you can sort of see why. So those are the kind of things that you want someone to at least give you pros and cons, especially if they're a legal advisor. Okay, so I want to talk about social enterprise failure, because no one ever talks about this, and I used to do this presentation quite a lot. Since my first social enterprise liquidated last year, which I'll talk about, it was just a bit of a sore subject, so I don't particularly talk about it too much in public, but I'm over it now. It's kind of like those post-divorce people, it's like, when you can talk about it, you know. So this is the failure rate of new social enterprises. So in the first year, about 30% fail. and then it drops and drops, and the key one is 4 years. 4 years after starting up, 50% of social enterprises will fail. And it's exactly the same as businesses. 50% of businesses fail within the first 4 years. And no one ever talks about it. It's just, there are literally three books on business failure. There's only one on social enterprise failure. And there is this myth, and I think it's the dangerous side of this, where people go, oh, be a social enterprise because you can do innovative, creative, and go, yeah, you can. It can be all of that stuff. But half of them will fail in the first 4 years. Have you sort of thought what you're going to do with that? And particularly in health, I actually asked, one of the beauties of not working at the Department of Health anymore, I asked Arvin Lewis at a conference, I put my hand up and I said, given that 50% of social enterprises fail in the first 4 years, how do you see the NHS dealing with, you know, if they put all these services into a social enterprise and it fails? And he said, well, the commission will have to find someone else to provide the services, won't they? And I thought, yeah, that's what I thought. I'm sure when you think back on that, you wouldn't have said it quite that way in public, but hey, you did. So there is something about, and I've heard, in fact, I was in a meeting down in London a while back where they had a number of people looking to set up social enterprises from the NHS, and I presented this, and the person at the Department of Health went, actually, no, social enterprises have a much, much lower failure rate than that. And I said, oh, really? Because here's my reference list. And if you've got a book and a study, I'd love to look at it, because it's a pet area of mine. No evidence. And I said, okay, well, all the evidence I've seen says that. And the DTI study at the Social Enterprise Coalition. Because in fact, the inland revenue, I have a very vested interest in this. So I said, it's kind of well known, established, it's been the same for a number of years. And it's not to scare people, but to say that setting up a social enterprise is not a risk-free activity. And if the eight of you set up a social enterprise tomorrow, odds are in 4 years, four of yours will have folded. And it's the same in business, and no one ever talks about it. You know, when people talk about business, they tend to talk about, you know, Richard Branson and Alan Sugar, and they kind of mythologize successful business people. But you say to them, okay, name 10 business people, and they often struggle. You know, they'll go, oh, there's that bloke from EasyJet and that bloke on the Dragon's Den. And you go, yeah, well, actually, one of the Dragon's Den's business folded last year but didn't get a huge amount of publicity. In fact, she got really irritated because they let it fold and then three of the other dragons bought it.
That was the Red Letter Days, wasn't it?
Yeah, Red Letter Days, yeah. Yeah. So, it's an interesting thing that you need to be aware of. And the main learning, I think, is looking at why they fail. When I first became an NHS chief exec, the first thing I did was I worked out why NHS chief execs lost their jobs. And then I worked out what I would have to do to not lose my job. And they by and large lose their job for overspend, waiting lists getting out of hand, ending up on the front page of the Daily Mail. Those are pretty much the three main ones. You could do anything else. You could be a functioning alcoholic. In fact, some of them aren't even functional. You can bully the hell out of staff, you know. You could shag your secretary on the front of the car park and nobody really minds. But if you overspend and your waiting list goes, you're on the front of the Daily Mail, out you go. So I'd go, okay, let's put some strategies in place. So the main reason they failed, the number one is cash flow. And this is the biggest thing. I've never really worked outside the NHS until 5 years ago. So I didn't really understand cash flow because I just thought people were selling businesses and we paid and everyone seemed to get paid and electricity's still on and finance people do funny things with it. And then you discover that if you have a contract and they decide not to pay you for 5 months and you run out of money and you need to pay your bills and your bank manager goes tough, you suddenly hit a bit of a brick wall. It's the number one cause of business failure. And it's actually why the foundation folded last year. We had £40,000 worth of contracts. We had £20,000 we had to pay out, so we had plenty of money coming in to pay it out. But we hit this brick wall, and the bank manager said we're not going to lend you anything, and we couldn't do a deal with the creditors to put it off. And so the creditors wound it up, even though there was more money coming in than out. So companies that are profitable can still fold, because quite literally you run out of cash. And that's where things like your bank, you know, banks are funny things. They give you huge overdrafts when you don't need it. And when you most need it, they can see that look in your eye and they just go, yank, you know. We had a bank manager, I'll tell you a couple of stories. We had a bank manager who had been trying to reduce our overdraft from £20,000, because we started off with £30,000 overdraft. Then we went to a £20,000 overdraft. And then at one point he said, well, I want you to have a £15,000 overdraft. And we said, well, we can't. We, you know, we're bobbing along. We're making a bit, but we need that cushion. Because the NHS are dreadful payers of it. They always pay, but one of them took 5 months to pay. Quite often they take 3 months to pay. The NHS is a bad pair of invoices. And what happened was, one of our invoices came in for a big lump of money. The big lump of money went in, and as soon as it went in, he went, oh, I've now reduced your overdraft limit. Without consultation. In effect, he just nicked £5,000 off us. But there was absolutely nothing we could do about it. Your bank manager can, at any time, remove your overdraft. And sometimes they do it, and actually will then make businesses fold. So cash flow is your number one. Tax issues and VAT. It's not that complicated, but the problem is, and it tends to be the classic thing that market traders, you know, they hear about people and the inland revenue come to them for like £1 million tax bill and they go, but I've got no money. It's because they treated the money coming in as all their money without thinking, actually the inland revenue is going to want that slice. So because they didn't put it to one side, then what happened is they spent it and then the inland revenue went, where's our slice? They haven't got it. And then they end up dragging people in. And again, it's kind of easier said than done, because if you're hitting cash flow problems and you know you've got some money that actually you do owe the inland revenue, but they're not asking for it yet, it's very tempting, and we've done it before, you know, to say, well, let's use that money for a bit and we'll be able to pay the inland revenue. Yeah, it's the borrowing piece to pay poor stuff. But it's the stuff none of the business books talk about it. No one will ever tell you about it. But you get a bunch of social entrepreneurs in a bar and they will tell you all their schemes for managing invoices, managing cash flow. It's all out there. Profit margin's too low. This can be a real problem, especially if you're trying to get business. And you go, we could do that service for, say, £200,000. And you think, well, it's going to cost me £150,000 to deliver it. It's £50,000 profit. And they go, oh, you know, we're only going to be £160,000. What you do is you slice your profit margins. If your profit margins are too low, there kind of isn't enough money. You're too close to the edge. So all you then have to do is maybe lose one contract or, I don't know, five people go on maternity leave and you're paying them and paying some more people, and suddenly you've jumped from making a bit of a profit to making a bit of a loss. Again, they all sound very financial, and most people aren't that interested in money. And I say, you don't need to be interested in money, but you need to remember that money's the thing most likely to sink you. So you need to kind of respect it enough to think, yeah, it's there and I need to understand it. Unproductive employees. If you're setting up and you have a bunch of staff and some of them are not, in the loosest sense of the word, adding to your ability to bring in income, then that's an overhead. And if your overheads are too high and you're not bringing enough income, you're making a loss. And it's a hard one. And it's particularly a hard one if you're cheaping people over. But it's something you have to think about. And I've often said to people, if you're cheaping a large amount of staff over, do you want all of them? If you don't want all of them, then get rid of the ones you don't need, but get rid of it before you cheap them over. Get rid of it in the public sector. There are perfectly legal HR ways of getting rid of people who are not up to the job. But an awful lot of the time, it's not tackled. And the problem then is you import them, you run a social enterprise, suddenly your costs are too high, and you need to shift employees, and then you start hitting some real problems. Because to do it legally, you know, it might cost a lot of money, might be quite time consuming, you may not be able to do it. You know, if they challenged it and took you to an employment tribunal and said you can't do it, that lump of money alone might make the difference between succeeding and failing. Over-optimistic planning, that's a big one. And in a sense, you're always going to have it. The idea that says, oh, we could win that contract, we could win that contract, we could be this big. It's great to have those dreams and those aspirations. The problem then is, if you do things on that basis, so if you think, well, I'm going to hire five staff because I'm going to win that tender, or, well, of course we're going to expand, let's make these decisions, and it doesn't come off, sometimes it can just, you know, you kind of need a pessimist somewhere in the group, that you go, we're going to be, you know, I think entrepreneurs will be, in 10 years' time, the world's largest social enterprise, and will be operating internationally. But it is possible, apparently, that it might not happen. So let's not actually plan on the basis that that's what we're going to do. And market shifts. And market shifts hits everyone. This is about startups, but actually big established companies. 25% of companies fail every decade. So the WH Smiths, the Woolies, the Marks and Spencers, the HMV, the Microsoft, if you actually track them, then there's a whole bunch of those fail, largely because the market shifts. So for instance, if your business is airlines, and you've been charging people £200 to fly from Liverpool to Dublin, and then someone comes along and goes, "Yeah, you can do that for 99 cents," then suddenly your market goes under. You either adapt or you fold. If your business is selling music in packages with shiny discs on a shelf, and suddenly iTunes comes along and is now the world's largest music seller, then you basically adapt or you don't. And sometimes very big established companies fold because actually people go, we don't do that anymore. You know, we used to work in that way, but we don't, and society has changed.
Can I ask a question about the market in this?
Yeah.
If the Conservatives get in,
yeah,
is that a market? Do you think there'd be a substantial market change? They sound very social or whatever. I don't think so,
because I think, funnily enough, social enterprise is actually, it's kind of a global movement. And I think where it's coming from is people saying the public sector is struggling, the private sector's doing okay, but there's an awful lot of people, particularly young kids, they're not as financially motivated. So saying to them, come and work for us, we'll pay you a lot and give you a big profit bonus, or we'll pay you a bit less, but you know what, you might change the world. A lot of people are saying, yeah, people are a lot more interested in stuff like quality of life, changing the world and the rest of it. So I don't know it's going to make that much difference. But the other issue is, to me, I think you compete on how good you are at what you do, not your organisational structure. So if I'm a social enterprise and I go, I'm going to compete because I'm better than they are, and actually it doesn't matter if I'm private sector, they're private sector, we're public sector, but we're going to compete, that's fine. I'm going to be good at what I do, and I'm going to make sure I'm good at what I do, and the price is okay, and I try and make sure I avoid these, then you're going to succeed, you know, kind of whoever's in power, really, you know.
If I wanted to offer like training places to people completing their counselling, or can you have volunteers within a social enterprise?
You can have volunteers in the private sector. Yeah, you can have volunteers in anything. I mean, volunteers have problems of their own.
Yeah.
The great thing about volunteers is they're cheap, stroke free. And they can have great experience, and particularly if they're ex-service users or current service users. The downside is you still have to manage their performance. And the danger is, if you've got volunteers delivering your services, how do you know that what they're doing is good, that they're trained, that they're as professional as a paid employee? And that's hard, because where's your lever? So there's nothing to stop you having volunteers, and I say to people, there's some really interesting scenes of volunteers. Don't underestimate the HR side of that. And how do you know that you're... Whereas if you're a paid employee, you'll take a certain amount of crap in terms of being performance managed and annual reviews and people auditing you and paperwork you have to fill in. If you're a volunteer, your tolerance might be a lot lower for that. And that's one of the issues. But yeah, there's no reason at all why you can't have volunteers doing it. Yeah. Any other... This is the down a bit. We're going to get the down a bit out of the way. But the important thing is, I'd remember that. There's like a reality check sometimes. People get caught up in the social enterprise bit. And I say a lot fail, and they fail for these reasons. So just plan. So make sure you have your contingency. Make sure, if you're going to have a bank, if you're going to have an overdraft, you get in some form of agreement and how quickly they can alter it. So one of the things is, with my new social enterprise, we operate entirely in credit. And a few social enterprises have gone down that route. So we don't have an overdraft facility. So the bank can't take money off you. If you have an overdraft facility, the bank can effectively take money off you because it's their money. Understand tax issues. You at least need to read. There's some dull stuff you have to read. Carve yourself a weekend and read some dull stuff from the Inland Revenue and the VAT, because it's important. If you get it wrong, it's bad. It is dull. Then try and do some fairly user-friendly stuff. Keep an eye on your profit margins. You have to have some money discussions. You have to know enough about money to not let it sink your business. My son won't sit in the room while I watch Dragon's Den anymore. Because when they put someone in, they go, here's my idea, and they go, what's your turnover last year? And they go, I think it was 30,000. It says it was 70. Oh yeah, it might be 70,000. What was your profit? Oh, it's 10,000. Is that gross or net? Oh, I don't know. Get out of the room. I've never met an entrepreneur who couldn't tell me the last year's turnover, this year's projected turnover. They knew the difference between gross and net profit. They're not financial people, but they knew those figures. I don't expect anyone to know their stapler spend. or what their cash flow projection is going to be in November. But actually, if they can't give me turnover and profit, and I go, you need to do some homework on this, because it is the stuff that will sink you, and it's the stuff that when people probe, they go, you haven't spent your time doing that homework. So yeah, I yell and throw stuff at the telly, and he goes, will you stop yelling at people on the Dragon's Den? And I just go, they shouldn't be there. You know, they should have actually been a screen process. They shouldn't be allowed to stand up in front of people and ask for money if they couldn't ask those questions.
Well, the programme wouldn't be what it was.
It wouldn't. Yeah, yeah.
That's why you enjoy watching it, because
Oh, absolutely.
It gets blood flowing, doesn't it?
Oh, you can nick some great ideas. Yeah, it's a whole bunch of stuff you can get some ideas. So again, employees, if you're looking to move, especially from the public sector or from an existing organisation in, get rid of them now. And I can talk people through how you get rid of people in a humane, legal, ethical way, but some people need to be got rid of. And if they're not at your job, it's actually kinder on them. Because, you know, I've had to sack, I don't know, 5 people in my life. I can remember every one of those conversations. That's horrible stuff, because you know the impact. You know they're going to go home and cry. You know in years to come, that might be one of their low points. You know it destroys marriages. You know, the suicide rate amongst men who've been made redundant is just ridiculous. You know that. So if you know that stuff, it's there. But sometimes, if those 5 employees mean 50 people are going to lose their job because the whole company folds, that's sometimes what you have to do. You know, so, like I said, that's the down stuff out of the way. So, has anyone got any kind of burning questions or they think we're not covering stuff? What I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through business modelling, the stages, how you move from where you are to where you're going, a little bit on marketing, and that will probably kind of take us up to lunch. Is there anything that's... talking quiet again. Do you yell? I really don't mind. Because I'm looking at... Okay.
I mean, there are questions that I've got...
I'm writing them down.
For instance, the difference between a social firm and a social enterprise.
Oh, that's a nice one. I can do that dead quickly. So social firms employ lots of people with a specific issue. So a social firm will employ 50% of people with a learning disability or a mental health. And that's why you have to be careful with the problem. It might be eating disorders. You might say, okay, 50% of the staff will have an eating disorder, as will 50% of the managers. You could do stuff around teenage pregnancy and say, you know, 50% of the staff will be, you know, teenage mums, or 50% of the staff will be from this community. The kind of idea behind social firms is one of the byproducts of social enterprise is people can get employed who might otherwise not be able to get employed. So, in fact, actually eating disorder is probably a really rubbish example, because I'm not aware of mass discrimination against people with eating disorders, but it might be from particular communities or people with particular... Mental health's a really interesting one. And in fact, there is some interesting ones on... They throw up a lot of challenges. So let's take bipolar depression. Half your management team have bipolar depression and half your board has bipolar depression. That is manageable. You have to start thinking quite creatively about...
Well, even the team,
it's not the people to
do it. As long as half are depressed and half are manic.
Absolutely. So how do you tap into people? How do you get that productivity out of... And you can get productivity out of a manic. And then you've got the how do you get people out of bed. And then you can do stuff like social contracts. And then you can get a board that goes, actually, we've agreed some boundaries, and your mental health is not crossing that boundary, so at this point, actually, we're going to ask you to not be involved in the game. So it's doable, and it's challenging, but it actually throws up some really rich stuff. I saw a group of people with learning disabilities where half the board couldn't read or write. Now, that's quite interesting when it comes to minute-taking government. So what they used to do is record all their meetings. They would record all of them, and if you wanted to know the minutes of that meeting, there was a tape. And so they circulated the tape, you listened to the tape, you went, yeah, I agree with that, or I didn't agree with that. That's dead clever. So that's the main difference. So usually a social firm has a specific purpose to give people employment and roles in governance who otherwise would find it difficult. So, yeah.
Why would you set yourself, even if your intention was to employ 50% of whatever, why would you set yourself up as... a social firm?
A social firm is a label. The characteristic, there's a group called Social Firms UK, And they usually, they there's no advantage to being a social firm at all. What they say is their criteria is, it might be 30%, it might be 50, but it's a big chunk, has whatever it is you're set up to do. Most people do it because part of their ethos of doing the social enterprise is about getting people into employment. So there's a lot of social enterprises that are about getting people into employment, and that's a good route of doing it. So in effect, they practice what they preach. And they say to people, yes, you can have someone with bipolar depression on the board because we've got one. And you can have people with wheelchairs doing this because we've got people. So they kind of lead by example and pressurise other people. It's interesting stuff. It's not particularly my cup of tea, but there's some really good social firms out there. Yeah. Any others that are just burning?
It'll probably come to me.
Am I talking too much? Do you want to talk to each other more? Because I'm conscious of when I get going. And
I think it's all very interesting. I suppose there's a very selfish part of me sort of thinks I want to work out what I want everyone to work on my problem.
Yeah. So well,
that's what's going to happen. This afternoon is going to be very structured about. By this afternoon, you're going to have action plans, next steps, that you're going to work together on. And Simon's going to talk through that. So we very deliberate. When we're looking at the day, I think actually that's a really important bit. Because at the moment, what you're getting is a shed load of knowledge, some answers, some stuff you want to think about. But also you need some next steps. And for some of you, it might just be reporting back to people, but saying, actually, here's some key stuff. Because people get hung up on the wrong thing, in my opinion. They get hung up on legal without, what do we want to do? What's our vision? They get hung up on HR when it's like, actually, this is the nitty-gritty type stuff that you need to do. Business models is a classic one. I heard a great quote about Business Link the other day. They said, Business Link will create a business model for you, whether you wanted one or not. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people out there who go, business plans, where's your business plan? Where's your business plan? Where's your business plan? Load of tosh. Absolute load of tosh, most business plans. When I say a load of tosh, what I mean is something like, I don't know if I've got any, but probably that much paper, a big wad of paper, going, that's your business planning. It's got your policies, it's got this, it's been drafted, particularly if you're in the NHS, because the purpose of a business plan in the NHS is to get a committee to agree to what you want. So they look for different paragraphs, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it takes 3 years to write, bless you. It's utterly pointless, it doesn't help you run your business. What you need from a business, and if you're going for an investor, you might need it. And if you're going to the bank, you might need it. So if you need one, you're going to have to write one. I'll email you some templates, there's some books on it. But don't let it sap loads of your life. Don't pay people thousands of pounds to do it because it's pointless. What you do need is what I call a napkin finance and business model. And the reason I call that is because most businesses get started in pubs or over a meal. And it's that conversation that goes, I hate my boss. My boss is a bitch, bastard, idiot, whatever. I hate my organisation. They don't treat people.
A couple
of pints later, we could run this so much better. How would we run it if we were running our organisation? A couple of pints later, yeah, we could do that. We could do it. It's before you're my best friend ever, I really love you stage. But somewhere between like pint one and pint seven, most business plans are creative. And often in restaurants, and often on a napkin. And all you really need, but you do need this, is you kind of just need to know this stuff. What is it you're going to do? And to some level, why? That's often the big distinction between stuff. What, you know, in a nutshell, what is it you're trying to do? Not in a big detailed way, but it's if you can pass the bar stool test. A lot of my metaphors involve alcohol. If you're sat at a bar stool and someone comes up next to you and goes, oh, what are you doing? You go, oh, I run a social enterprise. And they go, what is it you do? What you answer is what you do. Now, if your mission statement goes on for 15 pages, you will never remember that. So you might. So if you take McDonald's, I don't know what McDonald's business is, but if you stop someone at McDonald's in a pub and go, what do you do? Well, I serve burgers and chips. Yeah, cool, right, I get it. You know, some people have that kind of, what is it you do? I run a service, I help nursing homes run more effectively. I run a service, we provide really good inpatient, outpatient stuff for people with eating disorders. You know, I run this service, we do counselling, we help people get better and lead more productive lives. It's not the snappy byline, but it's kind of what is it that you're trying to do? And kind of why? Because often people who are driven to social enterprise it's very often because of injustice that they've seen, either they've been on the receiving end of, or they've seen other people and gone, it shouldn't be like that. You know, the hospice movement was started by people going, people shouldn't die like that. A lot of charities set up by people going, people with this condition should not be treated like that. This should be better.
That was part three of the workshop. You can find out more information and when we're running subsequent workshops on www.entrepreneurses.net. That's entreprenurses.net. I'm Dave Dawes, and part four will be next week. The music, as ever, is by DJ Booley under a Creative Commons license.